This month, Dig Deep is looking into socialism with our conservative commentator, Chuck Marone. Chuck's the president of Strong Towns, a nonprofit organization that reports on the financial health of cities. And our liberal commentator, Aaron Brown. Aaron is a writer, historian, and writes the Minnesota Brown blog that covers people and issues affecting his home territory on the Iron Range. Aaron is currently working on a biography of Vic Power, the charismatic mayor of Hibbing in the 19-teens and 20s.
We're going to talk about socialism. The interesting thing is that when this was broached as a topic, I thought, wow, very timely topic. And then I started to mill about it in my brain and realized I have some deep-seated, triggered reactions about the concept of socialism just in general. I thought maybe I need to, before I come here, schedule a session with a therapist or something to work through these,
like a top off right before you
get
in here.
These issues that I have, because I have a hard time thinking rationally about the concept of socialism. And then you show up with your red shirt and your,
you're trying to trigger me. Into this. I decided what shirt to wear. I said, well, why don't we wear a red shirt today? That could be, I'm even wearing red underwear. I got to tell you, I thought I'd really just step into the role and go all the way with it. Yeah. But I think what you're experiencing, though, is actually part of the story. It's not just right now and politics today that this issue gets heated. It's been one of the most hot-button subjects in our history and in the history over the last 150, 200 years on the planet Earth.
Right.
It's been a major, major thing that people have certainly been upset about, but also lived and died about. And I think that's why even today, it becomes a hot button issue.
As I was thinking about this topic, it's very interesting, the history, and I know we're going to chat about in this first segment the history. When I read authentic socialist voices, there's a little part of my Catholicism that is piqued. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay. Part of this sounds like this guy named Jesus and his program for how the world should be run. And there's this like discomfort that I have because as a Catholic, I'm kind of supposed to listen to this guy and follow him. Mm-hmm. And then he says these things and then I go and I'm like, but I'm not a socialist.
Yeah.
I have found this interesting transition between what I think is the, let's just call it the family level socialism or the community level socialism, which I think literally as a program for running things has been around since humans, you know, organized. And this more modern idea of how do we make a socialist policy a state effort? You know, how do we make this something that would transfer to the way we collectively govern ourselves beyond the tribe or the neighborhood or the community?
I kind of come back to the very root of like collectivism, because tribes, you know, the early bands of humans that formed and started societies often had some interpretation of collectivism. They didn't call it that. It was just what you did. You shared among your people. And so what was good for the group was good for everybody because of that sharing. A lot of Native American culture has a lot of that. And really just all over the world, you see examples of that in human history. As you point out, it gets a little more complicated when, as we humans developed higher order social systems and industry, and it wasn't just about food and water anymore, it's about money and prosperity. And then I think this collectivism becomes something a little different, or at least maybe it's not different. And I guess I think a socialist would say that it's not different.
Right.
It is in fact part of that same principle, but I think for a long part of history, because of power dynamics and because the strong became stronger and the weak were destroyed, and then you have this notion of, well, after a while, the strong have survived and they hold the territory. We have kings and monarchs through a big, you know, emperors and different interpretations of hierarchical systems, you know, as prehistory becomes early ancient history. Then you start to see a big distance between the top of the power structure and the bottom. And so the notion of all those people at the bottom collectively rising up or sharing in the prosperity of the monarch becomes a radical idea. You know, not that maybe wasn't a radical idea to prehistorical people or even a lot of collectivist societies, but for, European history, for a lot of Middle Eastern kingdoms and things, that that became something radical that was kind of purged from our minds, at least for all this time. And then we get into closer to our modern era, you know, as the revolutions of the American and French Revolution kind of start changing the dynamic out of that monarchical system, you see the roots of modern socialism form in that.
This is where I feel like there's a narrative here that is comforting to me that might not be the right narrative. In other words, there's a narrative of the history of socialism that to me paints it as this like evil thing. Mm-hmm. I want to give you a little bit of my narrative because I am aware of like the writings of Thomas Jefferson when he was in France as the French, as American ambassador to France. And he would travel through the countryside and he saw levels of inequality, I guess, to use the modern term. Literally, the concept of let them eat cake was apocryphal. I don't think it was ever actually uttered. Mm-hmm. But that was the sense, was yeah. that, you know, you had the monarchy, you had the, to use Marxist terms, you know, you had the bourgeoisie living this very high lifestyle, mm-hmm. completely out of touch with the common man, the commoner. And as Jefferson traveled the countryside, he was appalled at the level of poverty, the level of like abject want of just basics that the general population had, and not in an isolated sense. I mean, I think we can understand that there's like a homeless person here or this thing here, and these are individual struggles. But he looked collectively at like there's a whole not insignificant class of people here, like a huge percentage of population that are struggling. And then you had, shortly on the heels of that, Jefferson's last few months in France, the French Revolution. And you had, contrasting with the American Revolution, this insane period of time where you're cutting off people's heads and you have, you know, one form of tyrannical government coming in saying, you know, well, we'll redistribute everything this way. And then another form of tyrannical government would come in and take over from that and say, we're going to redistribute this way. And to me, my history of socialism begins with that insanity of the French Revolution. On one hand, a huge, huge income inequality, and then a reaction to that being versions of totalitarianism to kind of set that straight. That's where my rendition of it starts. Mm-hmm.
The purges after the French Revolution and the revolutions, the little mini boomlets that came after that. I mean, this was a horrible time to be in France. You wouldn't necessarily hold it up as, I don't think even a socialist would hold it up as, this is what we want to happen. It's what happened when you had such an inequality, and then human nature, vengeance, and then the power struggle as different people who used to be nobodies suddenly had a chance to run the country, struggled against each other, and you had all these purges. And the same thing happened in the Soviet Union to some degree as well after their revolution years later. And those were the things that scared the holy heck out of the rest of the world. You know, when you looked at the early, whether it was the early 1800s with France and then the reaction in Great Britain and how even like moderate politicians in Britain, if they didn't condemn what was happening in France, then they were against the king, against the queen, and they were going to be a big problem. And so there was like this Red Scare of sorts, even in Great Britain and other European powers at that time, early in the 19th century, or even the late 17th century. And then that same thing happened 100 years later with the Soviet October Revolution, where there was a sudden, like, frightening event. It's just pop culture, but like, Dr. Zhivago, if you watch Dr. Zhivago, you get this sense of like, oh, there was definitely a movement that had reasons for existing, but then you had these horrible human atrocities that occurred in the wake of the revolution that makes you wonder, well, was it worth it? But I do think, and if you come in between those two events, the French Revolution and the Soviet one in the early 1900s, right in the middle of that, you have Karl Marx.
I was going to bring up Marx. Mm-hmm. Because I do, you know, Marx, at this point, you have the first Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And you have essentially workers who, if you went back 100 years, were serfs. And then you had this merchant class. By the time you get to the Industrial Revolution, there's even a greater split between people who would be in guilds, which is their form of like professional unions, and then people who would be just workers. And the workers at this point were made into purely cogs, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Even more than serfs, which kind of had a little bit of a share of the crops they would produce.
The old saying in the early Iron Range, late 1800s, early 1900s, was that horses got treated better because they were more expensive and harder to replace.
Right.
You know, and so really the idea of a human being being just part of this machinery that extracted a mineral or made a product or wove fabric or whatever, that they were just part of the machine. That was the first reaction after the Industrial Revolution took place, is, you know, people could get work. You had to keep your costs down, so you just, kids have small hands, let's put the kids in there because they can get into the little machinery, you know?
Right.
Of course, it was horrible. We kind of laugh, but it was really horrible, but it was the way it was, and it wasn't questioned because, you know, because of those disparities in society that existed, the idea that your place was at the bottom if you were a worker or a serf or whatever, you know, because serf was no longer, you know, the feudal system had broken apart at this point. But there are all these people who descended from generations of serfs.
Right.
And what are they going to
do? What do they
do? What do they do?
Right.
You know, so they move into the city. What do you do with them? Well, let's put them in a factory. Let's get them working. And some of them are going to die. But that was the way it was before. So what's the big deal, you know? And so I think in the middle of this, Karl Marx, an intellectual, has, I think...
I'm going to spare you.
Okay.
Because I'm going to say, Karl Marx's insights and critiques of capitalism are right on.
Okay, good.
I mean, it's very hard to... It's one of these things where, like, it's very hard to argue that he did not, in the midst of this, have some deep insights
on diagnosed,
capitalism. Yeah.
He diagnosed a problem very acutely. He correctly... Not only that, you can even look to what happened later, and you could argue that what we see happening now is a continuation of his original diagnosis of capitalism. Left unchecked, it will do this, and then this will happen, and then this will happen.
Concentrations of power, concentrations of inequality. Mm-hmm. Basically, as capitalism runs its course, mm-hmm. the winners become bigger winners and the losers become bigger losers.
Right.
And that actually is a fair diagnosis of a system. And I think if you want to envision that in modern terms, you can think of like Google as being, you know, the first, not the first person to develop a search engine, but the first group to figure out how to do it and monetize it. Mm-hmm. And because they have now a decade and a half of data, it's impossible to catch up to them. Like, they are the winner, and they will always be the winner, and in their position, they can stay the winner. And you had this in industrial capacity back in the mid-1800s.
Right. And so 100-plus years ago, U.S. Steel Forms becomes the greatest corporate, the largest corporation on Earth. And as that time has gone by, now we see U.S. Steel as kind of a pale shadow of, like, ArcelorMittal, international company that's now the biggest steel company. But even so, there's even bigger companies than that, dwarfing and getting bigger and bigger. And the other thing we saw Marx was right about was the sophistication of the capitalist machinery in adapting to worker complaints.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why people took Marx and went into Marxism and even communism. It wasn't that Marx necessarily gave a specific prescription. He, Workers of the World Unite, kind of was a general tone. But so I don't think Marx even would have necessarily even endorsed what happened, for instance, in the Soviet Union as a final solution to this problem, because what you ended up with was totalitarianism and just a redirection of the power struggle that existed previously. Nevertheless, what I've noticed in talking about my research into early 1900s Hibbing, socialism was a different animal back then, before World War I, before the first Red Scare. Socialism was perfectly plausible, maybe not trusted, but it was a plausible place for a lot of people to land on. And a lot of Europeans coming here came here as socialists.
Let me put a little nuance on that.
Yeah.
I think you're right in terms of workers. I don't think you're right in terms of the powerful and the government.
Oh, and the business class.
And the business class. Mm-hmm. Because
I agree,
when the revolution happened in Russia, the abject shock and fear throughout the world, I had it described to me once as, you know, if we were to wake up tomorrow and the U.S. government was all of a sudden being run by two guys from Zimbabwe, we would feel like this was insane. Like, how did this possibly, like, how or could this possibly come
like,
about?
All of the gas station workers in the country had an uprising, and two guys wearing like a holiday uniform.
That's a really good.
Are now on our television as our
president, vice president. Yeah.
And there is an army standing behind them and they're in charge now. And you're sitting here going about your business thinking, what does this mean to me?
Right.
You know, and it's just amazing. And it's amazing for other countries too, because they're immediately looking at their gas station clerks wondering what if they're going to take over next. And that's not an accidental example, because I view the industrial workers of the early 1900s were what they called unskilled workers, the cogs that can be replaced. And I always say, we're in the service economy we're in now, maybe I'm segueing here a little bit, the service economy we're in now, those gas station workers, those service workers, hotel maids and cleaners and light manufacturing kind of folks are the unskilled workers of our modern era. And they're the ones, arguably, you can argue that, I mean, you can't really say that a party is for them. You can't really say that policies of either party are working for them right now.
Right.
There's some talk of it.
You and I have a broad agreement on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I know both parties would claim some aspect of the mantle of helping those workers. And I know that if we had a politician here from one of the parties, they'd say, oh, no, we got this. We're going to help them. But those workers don't feel represented.
Right.
And so in this environment 100 years ago, those workers were a potent and a dangerous weapon in a way that I don't think we realize today.
I'd like to, in the next segment, if we can, talk about that in the context of two socialist movements, the Communist Socialists and the National Socialists.
You can hear the next segments of this Dig Deep conversation on socialism at our website, kaxc.org, or through the podcast available. Links at our website, and it's through iTunes. Dig Deep is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.